It's my very great delight to introduce to you a good friend, a man who has been very kind to us Lutherans by paying some attention to us. The first time I met Dr. Spinks, he arrived at Westfield House and informed me that he wanted to learn more about Luther's view of, and the Lutheran way of doing liturgy, of examining it. He said, we Anglicans look at it only historically or aesthetically, but you Lutherans do it in terms of theology, and he wanted to get into that. And I think that tells you as much about the man as anything can. I consider that while I'm a dilettante at this, that he is one of the three most noted liturgiologists in the world today. The other two are very much his colleagues and friends, Paul Bradshaw, Kenneth Stevenson, and Brian Spinks. Now, he may demur on that and say, no. Kenneth Stevenson should not be included. But that goes back to another time when we were at a conference of the Society of Liturgical Studies at Colley College in Oxford, and Brian and I were standing talking away, and Kenneth came up to us and listened for a while. Then he turned, looked at us and he said, you Lutherans, you're all alike. He said, you just talk theology, and he walked away. And then as he got halfway across the large room, Brian turned to him and says, you Anglicans are all alike, and said that to him, to his back. But anyway, this is a generation of younger men who have made a tremendous impact in thoroughgoing liturgical studies, even in the area of being knowledgeable in all the five major languages of liturgical texts, and the outline of the books and materials that Dr. Spinks has written is quite considerable. If I may make a plug today, as I will tomorrow, in the bookstore we have gotten in several copies, I think about 20 of this book, which is highly recommended as Worship in Transition, the Liturgical Movement in the 20th Century, which surveys the scene of what's been going on in this century by Dr. Spinks and John Finnick. He is described in a brochure that had arrived today from our sister seminary, where they're having him speak at their liturgy symposium, as the following. Dr. Brian Spinks, lecturer, University of Cambridge, England, guest lecturer, University of Notre Dame, and Yale University. I think that, in a sense, gives you some impression of the caliber of this man's work and how it is finally being recognized more widely. There happen to be two of them at Notre Dame right now. Every time he goes into office, they have his records duplicated. It's part of the snafu of administration. But so one is speaking tonight, and the other one's speaking tomorrow morning. And tonight he is going to address us in a less formal way, in other words, not with a paper, but with some more free talk, and then try to allow as much time as possible for your questions. One of the book I went out of all the many writings, this one, we don't have copies right now in the library, but we hope to get some more again. This is the one that first drew our real attention to the man, Luther's Liturgical Criterion, his reform of the canon of the Mass. And here was an Anglican from Britain instructing Lutherans very much about their own liturgical heritage. And this, again, is a measure of the man. So here is an Anglican from Britain coming to St. Louis, the Mecca of North American Lutheranism, of course, to instruct us about our own liturgical heritage. And so we're very pleased, Dr. Spinks, that you're here to speak for us.
Thank you very much for your welcome and those kind words. The introduction of that sort, you can get carried away and think you're rather more important than you are. There are lots of things about liturgy I don't know. There are lots of questions that I do not have the answers to. Because I'm giving what I hope is an academic paper tomorrow, maybe torn to shreds and convinced that I shouldn't have come. But I want to be a little bit more informal tonight because I really want you to ask the questions that you would like to ask, the concerns that you have about liturgy and worship, rather than really hear about me, because my wife tells me, and my daughters say the same, that actually I'm a very boring person. There's a recent article in Lutheran Forum, September, written by Maxwell Johnson, who is the assistant professor of liturgy at St. John's Collegeville. It's entitled Baraka, Anaphoral Theory and Luther, One Lutheran's Response to Brian Spinks. And he begins it thus. In his essay, Baraka, Anaphoral Theory and Luther, the Anglican liturgiologist Brian D. Spinks offers three suggestions concerning the use of Eucharistic prayers for American Lutheran liturgy in the late 20th century. And I suppose that encapsulates one of the questions. Who is this peculiar English Episcopalian who dares to offer Lutherans advice on liturgy? So perhaps I can begin by being a little bit autobiographical, by saying how I sort of encountered Luther and why I thought Luther was actually important. Ron has said something about this. I very arrogantly, as a student, decided that not enough had been said clarifying why Luther was attached to the words of institution in his Eucharist, and so I decided to write something clarifying it and bringing together all the wonderful things that Dix and other people had said. But as I read through what they said, I felt there was something missing, and so I actually started to read Luther and felt that actually they'd got it wrong. It's a fairly arrogant thing to decide against such eminent names as Dix and Brilliot. But nevertheless, I stuck with the idea that actually Luther perhaps knew better what he was doing than either Dix or Brilliot did. So that's how I first published something on Luther and the canon. And then later I was persuaded to expand it into the study that Ron has mentioned. And it seemed to me that much of liturgical study was based on a historical method with far too many a priori assumptions, and also that its results never engaged with proper theological dialogue. They seemed to suggest that given the factual a priori assumptions, then the history demonstrated all that needed to be demonstrated. And I felt that that was doing a disservice to liturgy and to theology. So, hence, I expanded the study to try and defend or explain the fact that Luther was not a hatchet man coming like a maniac to the Roman liturgy, but knew exactly what he was doing and why, and was in fact giving liturgical expression to justification by faith through grace. But as I got to know Ron more and something more about Missouri Synod Lutheranism, I realized that for some Missouri Synod Lutherans, and perhaps for other Lutherans too, there seemed to be a problem of how you actually dealt with what was being said about the historical origins of Eucharistic prayers and how people were to interpret the fact that Luther apparently did not use a Eucharistic prayer, certainly not in terms of using the verba within a prayer. So in that paper, Baraka, Anaphoral Theory and Luther, which in fact I gave here, I attempted to try and explain how, as an outsider, as an Anglican, how I could see Lutherans might come to terms with recognizing what was being done in liturgical studies and at the same time reconciling that with their own theology and seeing a way through in a more positive way than some people were actually doing and writing. There were articles appearing saying that if you were a kosher Lutheran, you couldn't possibly have a Eucharistic prayer. And therefore there must be some fault theologically or methodology, in terms of methodology, in what was being said about the development of the early anaphora. Now I happen to share too that people were making that evolution far too easy. I nearly lost the friendship of Professor Tom Talley when I published in Worship something called Beware the Liturgical Horses, where I likened this evolution to that old dismal story of the evolution of the horse. that photograph of from the little horse to the big horse that appears in many biology books. That was from an exhibition put on in New York in 1905. But what everybody forgot was that the horses or the skeletons were not arranged in chronological order or from the same area. And it was simply a hypothesis of what might have been. People had come to see it as that's what happened, that's how it evolved. And that's what was happening in liturgical study, that people were saying, this is the prayer that Jesus used, the Birkat Hamazon, this is how it developed, and therefore this is what we must do. And it seemed to me that we simply did not have enough evidence from the pre-Nicene church to say any such thing. So trying to use what I saw as both the insights of liturgical scholars working in the early period, as well as the problems involved and objections, in that paper I tried to show how, as an outsider, I could see that there might be a way through for Lutherans. I think I had the humility to say that, as in fact Maxwell Johnson quotes, only Lutherans can say whether this is a Lutheran solution. Certain things that Lutherans have to look at that we Anglicans can't be bothered to look at, so it isn't a problem for us. I came back to Luther again 2 years ago I don't know if the published version was polemical, but one could accuse me of using it for polemical reasons. I was appointed to the Church of England Liturgical Commission back in 1986. The theory I have is that they decided I could do less damage on the commission than I could do outside the commission. I'm now a consultant, and I understand that in the year that I'm in the States, they are busy doing as much as they possibly can, so it's done before I get back. But one of the things that we were facing was revising our baptismal liturgy. 1980 alternative service book, we had a baptismal liturgy which actually in some ways, I'm not talking about the specific phraseology, but in structure, is found in most modern English-speaking baptismal liturgies. And that is partly because of the pastoral situation. Questions are asked about the parent's faith and intentions. Now, everybody from a pastoral point of view accepted this new service as being the right thing to do. And I have to say that as a curate in a parish, I accepted it and never questioned that this was absolutely right. Because being an established church in England, obviously we are open to baptize not quite on demand, but actually parishioners have the right of baptism in their parish church unless the priest can show extremely good reason why they shouldn't. And of course that can create all sorts of pastoral difficulties. But a number of people felt this was not a particularly good method of pastoral care, simply baptizing because people were English and belonged to an English parish church, this idea of a nation of baptized pagans. And so they were exploiting the structure of the new liturgy to try and say we will only baptize children of parents who meet our criteria of what a Christian is. And in some evangelical parishes, that meant that you were a fully paid up evangelical doing all the things that evangelical parishes do. And it seemed to me suddenly, particularly the people who, when I realized who was responsible for compiling this service back in the late 70s, that what had happened was that the covenant theology of Zwingli had suddenly been smuggled in to the Church of England, almost a federal theology, without us realizing it. And now it was being used, that before you have the child baptized, as in the Reformed rites, there is a covenant promise between parents and the church before one administers baptism. And it seemed to me that if we had gone down the Zwinglian road, nobody had told me, and I would actually like to know so that I can turn in the other direction or find somewhere else to worship. And so part of the point of this paper was to try and alert people to what was happening and to show that actually Luther, his view of baptism was that this is a sacrament of God's grace, That doesn't mean to say that we don't ask parents to promise, but at least liturgically that should come after the baptism as a response to grace, not as the precondition for justification. Because basically what I was arguing that what evangelical churches were doing was saying that somebody's salvation, i.e. a child's salvation, rested on the faith or good works or ecclesial business of parents, which I do not think is correct. So I argued that, again, in a paper here, and it was published in Lutheran Quarterly, and at least in the Church of England in our revision, we are trying to keep the promises out of that first part, to get out of this covenant theology, though, as you might expect, we're meeting with considerable resistance from the evangelical wing, who now they've got it in, want to use it as a lever to actually give us a federal theology. It's very gratifying that Max Johnson has responded to my paper in about Baraka and Afrel theory and Luther in a very positive way, and that's very encouraging. He did his PhD at Notre Dame and did it on the Egyptian collection of prayers by Serapion. And perhaps that does suggest why in his paper he says that why didn't I think of offering the Alexandrian pattern for Lutherans? Why the Syro-Byzantine? But it seems to me that you can only, if my presuppositions about the problems that some Lutherans have, if they are correct, one can only use the Alexandrine shape of anaphora if you actually do drastic surgery on it, because like the Roman canon, it has the words of institution within supplication, and it seems rather than in terms of thanksgiving that you find in the Syro-Byzantine pattern. But again, it may be that only Lutherans can answer the question of whether this is a legitimate way forward. But that is why I was hesitant in offering the Alexandrian pattern as a possible pattern for Lutherans. So I have valued Luther. I have to say that most Anglicans think I'm absolutely crazy, because I not only have engaged and looked at Lutheran liturgy and Luther, but also Calvin and Reform liturgy. I was the first non-Presbyterian to be president of the Church Service Society of the Church of Scotland in recognition of the work that I'd also done on Reform liturgy. So the Reform people like me, I think some of you like me, and the Anglicans look at me with great suspicion, and hermeneutics of suspicion whenever Spinks speaks, because he must either be trying to convert them all to be Lutheran or Reformed, and they're a little bit suspicious of this. I've spoken long enough, and this will become something about me, and I want us to talk about worship and liturgy and what questions you have. Perhaps I can just say something about what I've learnt about liturgy working on a liturgical commission. Quite a number of things. One, in our commission, we actually worked very well together in trying to work for what we regard as the best worship of the church. In the previous history of the Church of England Liturgical Commission, there was great party strife, people trying to score points whether they belonged to the Anglo-Catholic wing or the evangelical wing. Yet right from 1986, there was a very good, positive consensus that we would try to work to find a way through, that we, if there was a disagreement, that we could agree with, but that we would try and opt for what we thought was the best for worship. And so we actually produced quite a lot of work. But at least in the way the Church of England works, there are two factors which cannot be predicted. One, bishops. The House of Bishops always requests what it wants, and bishops, I suppose, are the epitome of the Anglican way of doing theology. They have selective amnesia, which means that 2 years further on, they have forgotten that they asked you to do something, and when you produce it, they look with horror and think that you're springing something on. And that is because their agenda has moved on, and because most of them don't know much theology anyway. I didn't say that. The second unpredictable feature is that anything we produce has to go through General Synod. And This is quite horrific when you think about it. I'm not sure how big the synod is, perhaps 400 people. So you go from what is basically a appointed liturgical commission of 16 people that draws up a liturgy to have it revised by 400 self-appointed liturgists who know much better. And the result is often quite horrific, especially because, again, people approach, I think, well, I suppose they approach a lot of things, but particularly the work of liturgists or a liturgical commission with a hermeneutics of suspicion and assume that you're trying to get one over on them. And they read things into your prayers or rubrics which were never intended. And also, quite a lot of them feel that they have the spirit and can do actually much better than anyone else. What comes out is often, as you suspect, a synodical liturgy which excites nobody and appalls everybody. But there must be some better way of doing liturgy, and the Church of England needs actually to learn that. I think the most interesting or amusing thing was that in 1986 we were asked to draw up four new Eucharistic prayers. They were supposed to be different from the prayers in the ASB. They were supposed to have simpler language, but not banal. Richer language, but not too rich. Suitable for children, but not childish. They were to have one form of institution narrative, but different forms. And this list of contradictions went on and on. So we produced four prayers, which are not four prayers that had we simply been asked to do four Eucharistic prayers that we would have actually sat down and done, but given the contradictions and trying to walk the Anglican tightrope, that we authored and thought answered questions. They were put out in a little book called Patterns of Worship, and the House of Bishops, who at that time were heavily engaged in, amongst other things, the ordination of women and all the problems this was causing, saw these four Eucharistic prayers and, oh horror, this was the wrong time, and there's never a right time, but this was definitely the wrong time to bring before the Church of England another four Eucharistic prayers. So this had to be delayed, and perhaps only one or two prayers, and some bishops felt that we had far too many anyway, and perhaps we should go back to just using the Book of Common Prayer. So these were sent back to the Commission. So we were now in about 1990, so we revised these prayers, and all of a sudden, the new synod, 1990, decided that it would be nice to have a Eucharistic prayer for children. Now, we were very hesitant to embark upon this work because we said the Roman Catholic Church, they communicate children before confirmation, or they will confirm them at the age of seven. In Church of England, it's still very entrenched, no confirmation before 12 years old, at least. And we said, why are we authoring a Eucharistic prayer for a non-communicating congregation? We thought that this was theologically unsound. However, we were told that's what Synod wanted and that's what we would do. So we reluctantly authored a prayer, and perhaps because it was reluctant, it was far from being our best work. So we now had five prayers. These five prayers went to the House of Bishops. The House of Bishops said, 5-2 prayers are far too many. You must select two of these. Two were selected and sent to the Synod. And Synod said, we are not children. We do not want you bishops to tell us what we can and cannot have. We would like to have five prayers. The five prayers went to the Revision Committee of Synod, which has only members of the Liturgical Commission if they happen to be members of Synod. So you have now simply people who are on synod who are interested in liturgy. When I hear people interested in liturgy, I try and leave quickly. That means something different from what I mean usually. They decided it would be nice not to have five, but six. So they had six prayers, and now we were in a power struggle between the laity, who said we want six prayers, and the House of Bishops, who were saying two prayers. And the House of Bishops very graciously gave way and presented to Synod six prayers. But we had now reached 1996, new Synod. House of Laity says, We weren't on the previous synod. We didn't ask for six prayers. We don't like these. We're not having them. So 11 years' work was thrown out in 1 hour's debate. So first of all, to be a liturgist in the Church of England, you have to have a good sense of humour. Second thing, we had on our commission, as a representative of the laity and of the Prayer Book Society that keeps an eye and very suspicious of anything a liturgical commission does, the distinguished novelist Baroness James, P.D. James, who over the 5 years came to realise that, first of all, the liturgical commission does not touch the prayer book. It cannot. It's enacted by law. It's not within our remit to have anything to do with it at all. And secondly, that perhaps liturgists weren't quite so bad and actually had something positive to say. And I have to say, we had a residential meeting of the commission starting the very day that the synod had rejected these six prayers. So there were one or two members of the commission that were really angry. I just laughed because I think I'd seen it coming 11 years before that something stupid could happen. But the person that was absolutely outraged was P.D. James, who said, "Who do these lay people think they are? They know nothing about liturgy." And that was very gratifying that he was a lay person, you know, actually showing appreciation for what we've done. Now, I've talked for far too long, probably about things that you knew already or didn't want to hear. So I'm going to shut up now, and I'd like you to ask questions or make comments, introduce things that are relevant and that you'd like to air. I think that'd probably be far more useful than me gabbing on any further.
The liturgy as something which they own, and the pastor himself can adapt it and change it as he wishes. Perhaps weekly he can offer new prayers and new patterns for the people. Is this something that Luther had foreseen, or how might Luther react to this? How did Luther feel about changes in the liturgy and how the liturgy?
I'm not sure that's the right question. I think the question is, how should Lutherans react? I mean, I don't know how Luther would have reacted. Remember that Luther has several sides to him. And on the one side, he lays down what he regards as a very formal Latin liturgy. He feels that there is a need for a German liturgy, specifically for the German people. And then there is that reference to that third rite, but the people hadn't got that far, and even Luther seems to have backed off contemplating what might happen where you have a group of people that are that far advanced in a spiritual life. So, if such a congregation fitted Luther's third category, then I suppose that would be fine. But I have a feeling that Luther was very hesitant that there would be many congregations that would ever reach that point. I think the danger that one's in if you're making up a liturgy every week, that it requires a respect and knowledge of a tradition, if you belong to what people often term a liturgical church, which often those who are prepared to author something every week simply don't have. So in fact, what you do is to cease to have a recognizably Catholic liturgy in terms of the tradition, and you have something made up every week that suits somebody's agenda or somebody's subjective feelings, and I think there's a great danger in that. I have to say that in Anglican circles, I tend to be, when I'm actually celebrating liturgy, tend to be conservative. I don't think that I have the right, very often, to make changes simply on my own authority. Because you are, although you may be academically and theologically correct, I think you're doing the wider church a disservice, and particularly the congregation. And if it is right for you because, or if I thought it was right because I studied liturgy to unilaterally make changes. What's to stop anybody? I mean, why should I have the right? Just because I study liturgy, I don't think gives me that right. So I think there is a danger. And there's certainly a danger that you have a congregation which is then floating away from its liturgical roots and tradition. I mean, unfortunately, we have that very much in the Church of England at the moment. At the faculty meeting I went to earlier this afternoon, somebody who had been in Cambridge asked me about the Round Church, which has now moved to Great St. Andrews. Now, I know that they will not use an Anglican liturgy. They have the main attraction is the sermon. They will sing choruses. They will have prayers that the ministers have written themselves. They have abandoned vesture. They walk around with a little tag saying staff. For heaven's sake, why not wear the vestments if you're going to do that? But they do not use Anglican forms. Now, they're allowed to get away with it because they are an extremely wealthy church and pay more than their quota to the diocese. So the bishop sort of turns a blind eye. But the problem they have is that that sort of church is very attractive to students who are in Cambridge. It's a great powerhouse. When they leave and go from Cambridge, they have nothing to go to, and they certainly find nothing in the Anglican tradition that they can hook on to. So in the long run, they are being done a disservice. I don't know if that actually answers your question. Okay. First thing is that the ordination of women to the priesthood is fairly recent, and a liturgical commission is appointed for 5 years at a time. So the lifetime of the present commission came to an end in March of this year. Now I'm reappointed as a consultant. I do not even know who is on the new commission. The previous commission, we had one woman deacon who was then priested. I'm not conscious of a different agenda from the rest of us, except in 1986, forced on our agenda by what I would regard as a minority, was to put out a booklet as to if parishes wanted to use inclusive language, recommended rephrasing of what is in our 1980 book. Point being that our 1980 book came just before inclusive language became an issue. Now, first thing is that is not the correct way of doing inclusive language. If you want to do that, you have to write prayers from scratch, not put out a book saying, in place of so-and-so, read so-and-so, because that just draws people's attention to it. And the second thing is, I'm glad that we delegated it to this woman and one other person on the commission. They went off and did it all, and we just had one all-day meeting on it, and the chairman, the Bishop Winchester, said at the end of it, "That has been the most boring day of my life." Now, that doesn't answer your question, but women, we've only had women priests now for still a year and a half, 2 years. I don't know how many women have been appointed to the new commission. It should not make, as far as I know, a great difference to the agenda. What may alter it is just how representational the commission is. Our commission was, when it was appointed, was quite representative. By the end of its life, it was totally unrepresentative because of ecclesiastical preferment. So, we had people who suddenly became bishops, Bishop Stevenson, We had people who had been parish priests appointed as residential canons or appointed dean of cathedral. And in the end, we had practically no parochial clergy left on the commission. They'd all been promoted into some other, or moved, I should say, into some other job. So it may be more representative now. And how many women are, I simply don't know, because I have not yet, even though I've asked, I have not been supplied some names. That's why I say, I think that while I'm over here, they're keeping me out of things so they can do what they want to do. And so it's all signed, sealed, and settled when I get back. So they think.
My sense was that Luther was very reluctant to even put in writing any suggestions for liturgy. If I'm correct in that, could you say, was that due to respect for the ancient forms, or not wishing to create something that had more than local scope?
I think Luther was reluctant, and the reluctance could have been, first of all, that he wanted to gather his thoughts on what the full implications were of what he'd been saying about worship and particularly the Mass. Secondly, I am sure that he realized that worship is one of the areas where people are most conservative. If there's any change in a statement of belief, many of them won't notice, but change something that is visual in the liturgy, which they do experience, they will notice it very quickly. Luther seems to me to have been forced into action because other people acted on what he had written, and he felt that they had acted rather too ruthlessly and caused offence and removed things unnecessarily. On the other hand, I think in Luther I recognise that whenever he says may or might, he sometimes got a bit cross if people didn't actually read it as should. But I think there were a lot of things that Luther felt were adiaphora, and that it was not for him to legislate as to whether people should use it or not. The custom itself would determine. Okay. Okay. Well, I think I find that difficult to answer. Just as I find, it's a bit much English Anglican telling Lutherans what they should do for an English person, because one of the problems that some of us have noticed at inter-Anglican consultations is that there is clearly a difference emerging in British English and American English, and ideas of what are politically correct. And therefore, what is deemed here to be as necessary for inclusive language is not quite the same in England. Inclusive language, I think, has been forced on the church in England by a fairly vocal minority of feminist people. When I've talked about it in two parish congregations, I think most women have reacted that they had never actually seen this before and thought it rather irrelevant. Some have felt that, well, now it had been pointed out to them, one could get rid of, let us pray for all men, let us pray for all people, and that seems to me to be fine if people's awareness is heightened to a point where they actually cannot hear the language, how it's generally used. But I mean, in England, we still use it, man and men, generically. You only have to read newspapers to find that out. So in that sense, our agenda is very different. Now, how it should be done, if it's going to be done, is certainly not by putting out a booklet saying, instead of this, read this. I think you have to write the prayer from scratch, otherwise it ruins the imagery, because it makes a difference as how you actually phrase the prayer. I think I've said this before when I was here, I'm quite happy if people are that concerned to use inclusive language when we're talking about human beings, but when we start tampering with how we address God, then I begin to get a bit restless and uneasy with it.
hear so much today about the liturgy being a barrier for people coming to the church, modern, both people. You mentioned with the roundhouse idea how it's so attractive. And then one of the problems with it is that they meet there and go to other churches and no place for them to go. I suspect that some people would say that's a problem with there not being any place to go versus the roundhouse approach. How do we react to that?
First of all, I think that objection is often overemphasized, that it's often an excuse. It's partly because people today going anywhere expect to be entertained, and liturgy is not entertainment. If it is entertaining, it's by accident. I can think of some examples where it's been entertained by accident. But it's not primarily there to entertain people. So people approach worship with a misconception of what's supposed to happen. And I think probably most people outside, and many regular members of a congregation, do think they're going there to be entertained. Now, having said that, I wouldn't want to press that too far, because clearly I think in past eras, people did, whatever else worship does, people actually did get a lot of entertainment out of it. It was a form of entertainment because it was not, it was so different, and it was a communal exercise, and there were not other entertainments with which to compare it or to compete with it. And today one of the problems is that since people do have this view that if they go to anything they're expecting to get something or to be entertained, then they will say, it's a barrier, I don't understand it. And I mean, one way that I suppose many churches do is to try to form some sort of bridge service so that you have a sort of an in-between liturgy which introduces some of what we would call normal liturgical diet with some informal things. But I mean, for heaven's sake, a lot of the informal things are, it's worship, it's not entertainment. So if you're not careful, you get into a situation where you're simply substituting one sort of liturgy for another on the excuse that this liturgy is a bridge. It's not, it becomes a replacement liturgy. And what you get is one congregation being built up on one sort of liturgy that doesn't have much to do with another congregation which is being built up on the other liturgy. In other words, it fails to act as a bridge. I mean, I think there's ways where you can make things more user-friendly in terms of layout in books, but no liturgy requires work and it requires preparation. If we go there to get something from God, we also go to give something and to take part and play our part in something, not to passively sit back and watch and expect to laugh or whatever. And I mean, this is one of the problems that I suppose that much of our liturgy still is based on either 4th, 5th century court ceremonial or academic ceremonial of the 16th century. And we have not found, because perhaps there is not a secular paradigm to use now, something that is suitable for its presentation in the 20th century. Instead, we get something based on a television chat show, you know, hosting it and walking around with a microphone. And I'm not sure that that, in the end, is particularly... I don't think it is decent and in good order. I think we worship is about something better than that. But that may just be a personal prejudice. I think liturgical churches can respond by, one, having the best possible liturgy they can compile, presenting it with decently and in good order, so that it is always well done, and thirdly, by explaining as much as possible of why it is done, so that people are taking part in the liturgy. And I think the danger of the television show paradigm is that in the end, it is no longer a liturgy of the people, it is the liturgy of the presiding person, the entertainer.
I'm not very familiar with specific Anglican practices in worship.
Nor am I.
Specifically, Lutheran liturgical practices or emphases
that you feel would benefit Anglican worship? Something that could be imported to that, to their prophet?
Well, I think two things. I think we've learnt now to try and be more theological. What we have not done is to apply this to our hymnals. That's where most heresy is proclaimed in the Church of England, in our hymns. And that's because we have a considerable schizophrenia that it's okay to sing anything, but you have to watch what you say. So perhaps we can learn that. On the whole, I think that Anglicans, well, not all Anglicans, but many Anglicans do have a sense that they have a name for being a liturgical church, and therefore that it should be well presented. It doesn't always work. So, and it may be that I'm not well enough informed at a practical level of Lutheran usage to be able to answer that. There aren't that many Lutherans in England.
In our denomination, we have several different worship books, and we have much variety and diversity with Lutheran worship, Lutheran book of worship, Lutheran hymnal, the creative worships that are printed every week and available from our synod. Do you see anything good or positive in this vast diversity? And assuming that answer, is there anything that can be done to perhaps unite us more as a liturgical church?
I find that difficult question to answer. I do not think that you have to have liturgical uniformity. I think liturgical diversity is acceptable. It depends on what you find in the diversity. I can't answer the question whether you think that Lutherans in North America should all have the same book. That was the original intention, and then something went wrong, and I can understand some of the reasons behind that. But whether Lutherans in America feel that that's still a goal which ought to be achieved if possible is for you to say, not for me. I don't think diversity is a bad thing, but it depends what the intentions of the diversity are. I think I'm trying to say that there may be a difference between diversity and unity, and a diversity because of disunity. I'm not sure that answers your question, but I'm not sure that I can answer it, really.
It's one thing to have unity of all Lutheranism in North America. It's another thing to have unity in your own denomination.
Right.
I guess the fact that in our own denomination we have so much diversity is a question, perhaps concern for some of us.
Okay. Well, I suppose it depends on the extent of the diversity and how far it diverges from what's in Lutheran worship. Are you saying there's diversity because actually, although there are books, people don't use the books? Because that's, you know, we have the same problem in the Church of England, and at the end of the day, that's a problem of discipline and whether... I was perhaps a little unkind to the bishop saying that money is involved, but that is certainly true. I'm pretty certain that if it was a parish with only 10 people that was losing money and they were using a non-Anglican rite, the bishop would be down on them like a ton of bricks. But the other thing is, I suppose the bishop asks, is this church attracting people? Is it preaching the gospel? And I think that he thinks that, well, probably it is, and therefore he is prepared to put up with the fact that they are having a divergent liturgy.
Bringing that same question, I guess, to the local parish, even with our Lutheran worship, we have 4 divine services. And even within those divine services, there are lots of variations cited as possibilities. With that in mind, not, quote, unlearned anymore. I mean, they're for the most part literate, I guess. And so I guess the question I'm asking you concerning is why Luther had these kind of basic, simple styles of whether it's confession and absolution or the German Mass, and then if it's still applicable to, in our local parish today, that kind of basic simplicity.
Well, I suspect the simplicity is both the points you raised, and or both the things that you suggested. Seems to me that he wanted to teach people that they must understand what it's about, and that therefore there is no need to be complicated if you can be simple. Whether because we have our higher standard, or supposedly higher standard of education, that we can do things more complicated or sophisticated, I don't know. I'm not quite sure how that question relates to how you started by saying that you've got several forms of divine service. That seems to me to be fine, because if you have a liturgical church and you know that there are liturgical fidgets, then one way to cater for them is to say, hey, you know, you've got a choice, don't be greedy. Right.
I wonder how far we should be able to, how far, even from a pedagogical point of view.
Well, I think that it may be that I'm now contradicting something I said earlier, but it seems to me that might connect with the question that was over here about an individual parish, in that given that you belong to a particular church with a tradition, each congregation may have its own particular characteristics and needs. So one way of catering for that is to give some room for manoeuvre in the structure of the service, or provide alternatives. I mean, I'm not sure. The problem that's had in the Church of England is that people have said, but in the past we had common prayer. The text was the same whichever church you went. Now, in a sense, that was true. The way it was presented was different. You know, if you kept your eyes closed, you wouldn't know that one person was wearing a surplice in another church. Well, you could smell the incense, but you couldn't see the... But it was the same text. Whereas now that is not so, because there are choices to be made, and things can come in different places, and therefore the complaint has been made, we are moving away from common prayer. But it raises, at least for Anglicans, what do we mean by common prayer? It means, or we've argued that it means, that in any given service you will find certain things like a creed, a Lord's Prayer, a collect, a reading of Scripture. It does not mean that you will necessarily have them in exactly the same order. Now, I'm not sure whether that concern with common prayer applies to your tradition in the same way. I suspect, given the many Lutheran orders of the 16th and 17th century, that's not so. There was always room for diversity according to area. Right. Okay, so in that sense, diversity is something new.
Would you like to discuss the need for and the limitations of enculturalization in liturgy?
I have, yes. I think that liturgy needs, what it mustn't be is of an alien culture. And one can think of examples, particularly in the mission field, where something which is decidedly Western has been imposed or brought to a completely different culture. And it's a question, I suppose, then of sorting out what is primary in worship and what is simply adiaphora, or what is cultural expression. But I mean, the great difficulty, is, as you say, I've written on it, is certainly for Western people to see their own problems, and where some of these television show things are enculturation of the worst sort. You know, it's always a question of balancing enculturating it without surrendering the gospel to the surrounding culture or prevailing culture. And quite often, I think, if you're within a culture, you cannot yourself see that. It's often when you're somebody outside who can see that. And the only, at least my train of thinking was not so much with liturgy, but with the whole organization of the church. The Church of England actually asked representatives of other parts of the Anglican Communion to do an audit. How did they see the Church of England? And the report entitled To a Rebellious House, in which it pointed out, you know, from people outside, lots of flaws. As you might guess, that report was sort of hidden and lost because it said too many painful things. But it's only if you're outside that you can see those criticisms. And I think that's probably the same with enculturation. If you can see what's gone in a liturgy in another culture, it's very difficult to enculturate your own. And there's that, you know, Aidan Cavanagh's thing, it happens, why worry about it? I think we have to be sensitive to it, but if you do it artificially, it's going to fail. Yeah, we have to be sensitive as to where it can or might, and allow it to if it is going to, rather than actually try and force it. Well, I think there's always been an emphasis on praise of God. I think historically it was mostly placed in what we would call the divine office, the morning and evening worship, where I think most liturgologists will say the evidence points to the early divine office being simply praise and intercession, no psalmody in sequence. Psalms appointed for the time of the day, no scripture readings, and that's still true except at Easter in the Assyrian church. There's no scripture read at the divine office, and therefore no preaching. And at the Eucharist, there is praise, but also obviously there are lots of other things going on. I'm not quite. Do you mean the emphasis on where, you know, the congregation are going to sing 3, 4, 5 hymns or choruses and. Oh, I see, yes. Oh, right. Yes, I mean, I've encountered some things where it praise means seeing some choruses that are put up on an overhead projector and then a minister's monologue. And I went to the most horrific thing at in Oxford. I thought I was going to drop in for evening prayer and it was a Eucharist. And it was Oxford's counterpart to the Round Church. So there was a stage, there was some guitar playing, and the senior minister introduced himself. We had a collect, which was from the prayer book, or from the Anglican liturgy. We had a confession, which wasn't, and we had an absolution, which wasn't an absolution. We then had some more praise. We then had a reading, and then we had some more praise. We then had a gospel, which certainly wasn't the gospel that I'd read when I'd celebrated that morning. So I thought, well, fair enough, the sermon's going to be on this gospel. That's why I substituted. Oh, no. After the gospel, we had more praise, and then we had the sermon, which was on a verse of Hebrews, which, of course, hadn't figured in any of the lections. And the sermon was great entertainment, and it was punctuated with pauses, and the congregation laughed. And I sat there thinking, there's something wrong with me. I can't see anything funny in this. And I jammed myself at the back because I thought this might turn out to be sort of a healthy place to be. And somebody came and sat in the pew after the service started. And every 5 minutes he looked at me and grinned as though I should be laughing at this sermon as well. And after an hour, we then had some more praise and I'd had enough. I just left. I know what you speak, and
so
Well, yeah, I mean, my question is, I cannot see what people see in that is so attractive. I mean, we had the question of people feel that liturgy is a barrier or even boring. I mean, there was nothing funny that I could see. And after a while, you know, singing three choruses at a time and then sitting down for something and then singing three more choruses, that was boring. I'm sure the Lord was bored as well. So, yeah, I mean, it becomes an obsession, I think. And it completely unbalances the service.
Can you see any parallels in your reading with Luther about things that have gone wrong with Rome clergy, as well as Karlstadt, who forced reforms in his day, where he could diagnose what was going on both in Rome.
Well, I assume that the I don't know about the parallel to Rome, the parallel with Karlstadt and Munster, I suppose, are the parishes that run ahead and do their own thing because they think they've found the answer. I mean, part of, not only did Luther disapprove of what they were doing, I mean, it's a bit more complicated than I'm making it, isn't it? Because, I mean, where Munster's concerned, you actually look at his liturgy, it's actually more conservative than Luther. But the underlying theology, and particularly some of the antiphons he was using, with its eschatological, or rather strange eschatology, that the end was about to come, I think that's what frightened Luther, quite rightly. And so that's why he recoiled there. But I suppose it was also that these people were rushing ahead and doing it without thinking of the consequences of either taking the people with them and whether what they were doing was theologically sound. I suppose that goes back to my, you know, the comment I keep making about the round church, that however theologically sound their preaching might be, they're not thinking about the long-term effects. I mean, are they actually trying to... where are these people supposed to go? If they're supposed to be becoming Anglicans, then where, unless they find something equally as different, I was going to say something different, they're not going to feel at home, or is it they're going to be sent out to other churches anyway? And it seems to me that actually what the round church is doing is ducking questions of ecclesiological questions. And I'm not sure that in the end you can take something like that too seriously for very long. I mean, it may be preaching grace at every sermon, that's marvellous, but okay, what next? And what about these people as they journey through life? Where are they supposed to go and what are they supposed to do? What does it mean to belong to church? And those questions I don't think are being addressed by that church. And I think, my suspicion is that those questions were behind Luther. And what was going to happen to Munster's congregations? Where were they going? Where were they going to end up? Well, we know where it ended up. Well, it would seem to me that you have to answer the prior question or questions: who are the Roman Catholics that are now finding fault with their liturgy? Where are they coming from? What is their agenda? And I suspect that if you answer those questions, you will perhaps conclude that the Lutherans stay where they are, because I don't think they are the sort of answers that Lutherans would want to share in. I mean, there's basically a conservative reaction to the liturgy because they're the present occupant of the chair in Rome, I understand, wishes to interpret Vatican II in the light of Vatican I, and therefore there is a conservative mood. That does not mean to say that the reforms that went through in Vatican II are therefore wrong. If they're wrong, they're for other reasons, or reasons other than that. I think that the liturgies are being questioned. I mean, where liturgists are questioning Roman liturgy is where it is perhaps clumsy or has not gone far enough. I mean, I think the intention was, for example, the divine office should once more become a popular office used by lay people, and it has failed, and therefore is the format wrong? What has got to be done to have a divine office that can once more be used by lay people and become, you know, a regular Sunday evening Vespers? Those questions, I think, are being asked by Roman liturgists. There are people with other agendas who are trying to turn the clock back because they somehow blame all sorts of problems in the church on the change of liturgy. Now, that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, the blame has to be shouldered elsewhere as well, if there is any truth in that liturgy is to blame. And I suspect it's not. I mean, it's very interesting that I live in Notre Dame in Columba House with lay brothers, who most of them are retired, and therefore they lived through all these changes. And, you know, you hear them saying, heavens, I don't know how we put up with all that Latin stuff all that time. And you know very well that they wouldn't want to go back. So, and the lay brothers are very good. They're very suspicious of clergy, and they're suspicious of him in Rome too. So, you know, I think there's another agenda which is heading this attack on the liturgy. It's not from theology of liturgy itself. I may be wrong, but that's where I think it's coming from. Well, yes, I mean, I agree with entirely with what you said. And I think the other thing is that, you know, the idea of changing the liturgy and what you say every week. There's a Reformed, United Reformed Church minister in England who was completing a PhD. It must be finished by now, but I haven't heard that it is. Looking at the importance of repetition. He actually did a degree in linguistics first. And so he was looking at his own Reformed tradition. In terms of the importance of worshippers in repeating things. And I mean, the point that he was trying to make to his denomination is that although they claim not to be bound by a liturgy, actually not only is there a fairly regular structure of things coming in exactly the same sequence, but also if you listen week by week to what the minister is praying, he is repeating phrases every week. And so that actually this is... repetition is fairly important, and he was sort of arguing from there that perhaps the Reformed Church should use, at least in parts of their liturgical service, responses for the congregation more regularly so that there is more repetition, because that's actually quite important in terms of rhythm of somebody's spiritual life.
We look forward to hearing more from you tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.